This is special programming on the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Tonight we head to Butte County and hear from Public Health Officer Dr. Andy Miller about the two positive confirmed cases of COVID-19 that were announced there over the weekend. And NSPR's Dave Schloem speaks with Jared Kaler, superintendent of the Corning Union High School District, about his perspective on what's involved with closing a school and how they're moving forward. Don't forget, we want to hear from you. Let us know how you're dealing with the crisis on our website, mynspr.org. You can also leave us a message at 433-9216. For Monday, March 23rd, 2020, this is special coverage from North State Public Radio. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Over the weekend, the North State went from having one positive confirmed case of COVID-19 to seven. Yuba-Sutter counties announced three, Shasta one more, and Siskiyou and Butte counties two each. Today, NSPR's Andre Bayek spoke with Butte County Public Health Officer Dr. Andy Miller about his county's approach to the news and why few details are being released about the patients and the places where public exposure may have happened.
Even though people are curious and they think it's relevant to them, it doesn't change the guidance that we give. It doesn't change the recommendations. It's not being done elsewhere in other counties or in the state. So everyone in our county is at risk at this point, and everyone needs to be following that same guidance, whether they live in one city or another.
That information has been released before, such as during a local outbreak of measles last year. Why is this situation different?
Yeah, because measles is a completely different disease, which has, you can become infected when you move into a space even hours after, or an hour to two after. And we had single intrusion into our county. This is much more like influenza, where there isn't a single place. There are multiple entry points. It's not reasonable or effective, or again, will not change the advice that we give for that information to go out. So often those people actually don't remember those things very well, but even if they did, that would not help in this situation.
With these confirmed cases, what are the next steps for Butte County Public Health toward addressing the virus?
Well, so there's two different kind of philosophic approaches to trying to help with an outbreak like this. One of them is containment, and that is when you know of a case, you try to isolate those people, you try to understand who their contacts are, and we try to give advice and quarantine those contacts. So that's what we do and are doing and will continue to do as long as we are able. The other is mitigation, which is more population-based intervention, which is the social distancing that you've seen and, you know, which goes with school closures and many other interventions that we're all living with. So that is not an individual case and case contact-based approach. That's the population-based approach. And the most important of our messages and the most important intervention that we have, given that our access to testing is still limited.
Can you explain the current situation as it relates to testing?
The situation that we have has been pretty much the same for a while now. There are two pathways towards testing. One of them is if there's a person that meets certain criteria and certain risk factors, the physician or the primary care provider or the hospital doctor or whoever can contact us, and we can try to facilitate that test going to a public health lab. Public health labs have very limited capacity, and so they have to meet the certain criteria, and of course we have to hope we can get the results back within the time that we need them. The other pathway for people that may or may not meet those criteria are for the ordering physicians to send them to commercial labs. So those are the two pathways to testing. That second, the commercial lab pathway, also, because of the demand in our country, state, have capacity limitations. And even though they can run thousands, the demand is much higher than capacity. And so some of them have stopped accepting new specimens over the last few weeks and are waiting to try to get through their backlog.
Given that demand, is Butte County competing with larger counties and cities to receive supplies?
Well, you know, I haven't used the word competing, and I don't think of it as competing, but it is true that we are all asking for supplies that have limited capacity. So most of our requests, first thing that happens is we ask our healthcare partners to use their standard suppliers. If that doesn't work, they can request that public health pass up resource requests to the state, and the state is determining who gets how much. And so they try to look at the need and the burn rate, so how quickly those supplies are being used, and trying to get everybody in the state supplies that will last them for a certain amount of time, be that 2 weeks or a month. That's how they're trying to prioritize that. So, I mean, we have the same opportunities for testing as most other counties in our area.
Can you explain how the local public health department is coordinating with local hospitals and the precautions, perhaps, that those hospitals are taking in screening patients who may have been exposed to the coronavirus?
Yeah, so, you know, in a way, I can take that question way back and say that we meet with our hospitals in emergency preparedness and have done so for many years. But specific to this event, we have met with them frequently, usually a couple of times a week, either in person or virtually. We have been a conduit by which they are made aware of California Department of Public Health and CDC guidance on many, many things, including how to screen patients who have respiratory symptoms to minimize the risk of their staff and others in the hospital coming into contact. And that work really has been in place, and the changes that they have made in light of that guidance has been in place for a few weeks. We have coordination multiple times a day with them between our clinical staff about potential cases and sample and specimen collection and processing. So those are just some of the ways that we work with them.
Is the county receiving any outside assistance, perhaps from neighboring counties, perhaps Sacramento County?
I'll go back to testing and lab. We receive, as I said, there are two pathways, and one of them is the public health route for a limited number. We are able to send some of those samples for testing to Shasta County, some of them to Sacramento County, and some of them to the state public health lab in Richmond. So other counties in the area have been sharing approaches and plans and thoughts, and so that coordination happens frequently. The other Knott County that's been a organization that has definitely helped is the North Valley Community Foundation and their $250,000 to help get equipment and other things in place to allow testing to occur here in Butte County.
Now that there have been confirmed cases of COVID-19 and more are expected, how should the public prepare and respond to those facts?
I think that they should respond by heeding the advice that's been given from the CDC, from our president, from our governor, and from our local officials, only one of which is myself, asking them to limit their contact with other people, to only engage in essential functions and the travel that supports those essential functions. There is nothing more important than that.
That was Butte County Public Health Officer Dr. Andy Miller speaking with NSPR's Andre Bayek. You're listening to special coverage about the novel coronavirus from North State Public Radio. Stay tuned. This is special coverage from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Teachers and parents all over the North State have been thrown into a situation where kids are no longer leaving their homes to attend school. This was not a decision that was made lightly. Earlier this week, NSPR's Dave Shlom spoke with Jared Kaler, superintendent of the Corning Union High School District, to learn more about his perspective on the pandemic. The first thing Shlom asked was when Kaler first got COVID-19 on his radar.
I think for us, certainly locally, it kind of really came onto the radar when we began to prepare for our Japanese exchange students coming. And so for us, that was supposed to happen back in February or early March. I can't even really remember now. But that was the thing that put it on our radar at first. And then from there, we realized that in early February, we had had some students that had been in Italy. And so those were the two things that really pushed it for us onto the local radar, and we had to start making some decisions. And from there, it just has evolved so quickly over time that it's pushed us into the school closure piece. But I would say that those two exchange trips really put it on our radar, more so than just, you know, like everybody else watching the news every day.
Yeah, and just to be clear, the Japanese students come and visit our high school, have for the last few years, every year at this time of year, right?
Yeah, that's true. And so every year in the spring, we have a group of Japanese students that come and visit our school for a week or so, and they do various things around the North State. And that's important for our kids, and our kids look forward to it. And I know that the Japanese students look forward to it. But this year, that wasn't able to happen. And the decision for them to not come was actually made on there. And as you know, the COVID issue was earlier in Japan, and so they made the decision not to come. But we were prepared to make that decision as well.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go to the dynamics of you having to come to a decision with the other superintendents, I imagine, and other authorities in the area. Can you walk me through, like, over the weekend, how you went from, like, Friday, you know, where you were, to the decision to close the schools? Can you take us through that process?
Yeah, sure. So actually, the Friday the 13th, I believe it was, which was our last day in session, I actually happened to be in Sacramento at a training already where our legal counsel was. And so we were watching the news quite closely because there were rumors already that the governor was going to make an announcement and that announcement would have an impact on schools. And so there was anticipation for the governor's announcement on Friday night. When that announcement came out, you'll remember that large districts across the state of California were closing their schools one after another. And so we were really faced with that decision. But the governor's announcement that Friday night didn't mandate school closures. So over the next 48 hours, Saturday and Sunday, Tehama County officials were trying to get on the same page in terms of what does the governor's order mean for us, or what does the governor's guidance mean for us, and how do we respond to this locally. And so that situation evolved. But one of the things I think is important for people to remember is that if there's not clear direction from state or federal authorities, those making decisions on the local levels have different people to answer to. And so your school superintendents, for example, all work for locally elected school boards who ultimately are their bosses and their authorities. And so remaining on the same page requires a lot of communication. And so that's what was going on over Saturday and Sunday. Eventually, it just became clear for a variety of reasons in a variety of districts that it wasn't going to be feasible to have school this week. And so Sunday afternoon or evening is when that call was made, and then it eventually went out to everybody else. But the really interesting thing, especially in a rural county like Tehama, is the varying needs that districts have. We have districts that have as little as, you know, 30 students in them. And so what are their needs as compared to the larger districts in the county like Corning Elementary, Red Bluff Elementary, Red Bluff High School? And so trying to make sure that everyone's needs are met while also trying to be as consistent as we can, because that's important for our community, that's kind of the balancing act that was taking place over the weekend.
And were you in touch with the other superintendents as well? Were you also in touch with, like, the county health department? Were they involved in helping you make this decision or giving you any kind of advice?
Yeah, I can't say enough about our Tehama County Health Department just in terms of their accessibility. For me personally, through this, I've been able to email directly our executive directors and our, you know, public health officer, get answers and responses to them. I even Sunday afternoon, when we were still trying to figure out what we were going to do, I was able to speak on the phone with the executive director of public health. So great communication for us from our local public health authorities. We've been very appreciative of that.
And then, of course, the decision to close the school happens on Sunday night. And that's when I found out about it. And then you go into this next phase, which is how do you communicate this to the parents and the students, the community? So you know, tell us a bit about that. Like, what do you have to do to let people know what comes next?
Yeah, it's quite an interesting process because you're faced with this dilemma of we want to get out information as quickly as possible to our community. But some of the very questions that they want answers to, we don't have answers to yet because it's such a quickly changing situation. And the guidance, again, from the state and federal authorities, understandably so, is rather vague on many of the issues that affect our students. So in that way, we want to get information out, but we can't always know exactly what that information should be. So we're trying to walk that balancing act. You know, so for us, that includes social media posts as soon as possible when we know anything that's going to directly affect people. So that includes things like food service or closure dates. More detailed information in terms of distance learning and things like that, we try to put out a little more slowly, a little more deliberately, so that we can make sure that it's detailed enough for parents and people to understand. So we're using our all-call systems, we're using social media, we're using email to staff, we're using contact with news organizations, everything we can to get that information out. But immediately, once you have the information out, there's numerous questions that you're trying to answer for folks. So it's been a challenge, but our community has been great and really understanding through that process. And we're going to continue to try to keep them informed as we can.
And now you're in the phase of you rolled out, all of your teachers put together packets, right, for your students. So tell us about that and how that worked. You know, walk us through the decision, because not everybody has the connectivity to just go learning online, you know, all at once. Tell us about, you know, what Corning High School did and a lot of other schools have did to, you know, to keep students involved in learning.
Yeah, that's a great question. And the distance learning piece, I'm going to be honest with you, is probably one of the biggest question marks every district in the state is facing. What does that actually look like? You know, public schools, K-12, are not equipped the same way that higher education is in terms of student connectivity, right? And so we estimate, for example, that around half of the households in Corning don't have Wi-Fi access in their homes. Most of their connectivity is a single phone or maybe a couple phones in the home. And so once you realize that there's that connectivity issue, and then you add into it, these are other things that are barriers for folks. We have students that are English learners as a second language. We have students with disabilities. We have students that we support in a variety of ways to help them access curriculum and education. And so it's not as simple as just putting curriculum out to people. There's supports and instruction that go with that. And our students, many of our students need those supports and instructions to be successful, and we're committed to giving it to them. But that's obviously a challenge in this climate. And so those are some of the questions that we have to start working through over the next week, really, because it looks like this is going to be longer rather than shorter, obviously. And we want to do that really well for our kids.
And so tell us a bit about how, you know, I saw pictures on social media of long lines of cars, of parents coming in to pick this material up. How did that go?
Yeah, so that was interesting. So our initial response on the distance learning was we want to get something to families as soon as possible, just so we can support them and communicate to them that we're with them in this. And so that parents have something for their kids to be doing during this time. I'm a parent, and so I know that keeping your kids busy in this time is important, not just for them, but for the parents as well. So that was kind of our angle on trying to get the packets out as soon as we could. We knew it wasn't going to be as high quality as having students here. So we asked our teachers to do that. And with our help of our paraeducators and some other staff, we collated an individualized packet for every student in our district, which is about a little over 1,000. The first day that we had those available, we had about 700 families come get their packets for their students. So, you know, around 70% of our families were there within the first 2 hours those packets were available. And that's just a testament to our kids and our community and their parents and the commitment that everyone has to doing their best in this situation. It was, I made the mistake of announcing on social media while we opened the line, and then that just ended up backing up the line all the way out down to Solano Street, which is the main street in Corning. So it was quite an ordeal, but it was positive overall.
Yeah, well, you learn as you go. Nobody's ever done this really before, so it's all uncharted territory, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about food services, because one of the big worries across the country about closing schools is for many families, you know, for the students, you know, that meal they get at school is one of the most important meals of the day. And that's an important role that our schools are playing now. So tell us about, you know, how your school is handling that.
Yeah, I think one of the really important things for the community to realize would be that as we talk about things like distance learning or food service, there are certain things that we are really well equipped to do right away. And there are certain things like distance learning that are going to take us a little bit more time. And so food service is one of the things that we're pretty well equipped to do right away. And the reason for that is obviously we have the facilities and the staff and the supplies, but also we receive funding from state and federal authorities specifically for breakfast and lunch meals. And so the states and the feds have graciously said, keep feeding people and we'll keep paying you for it, essentially. And so school districts are able to do this without a financial burden thus far. With that said, there are going to continue to be challenges to continue that program, but we're prepared to overcome those. So thus far, it's been very successful in our district. Yesterday, when we handed out the packets, we ended up serving over 1,600 meals to our community. So in a school of 1,000 students, to be able to get out 1,600 meals, that's a breakfast and a lunch for 800 students. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And are you doing that every school day or non-school day now?
Yeah. So we have food available Monday through Friday every day. And basically we've worked with environmental health and our staff to figure out a way to try to have a drive-through system where families don't have to get out of their car. And we just hand them a brown paper bag with two meals for every person under 18 in their home. And it's been pretty great so far.
Yeah. And then I'll also talk about, even though the teachers are basically at home, you have staff that are working there at the school. Talk a bit about the maintenance staff and, you know, all the work that they've had to do to, you know, you've got a school that, you know, possibly is contaminated with viruses that you don't know about because there hasn't been testing. Talk about, you know, all that went on in terms of maintenance.
Yeah, our maintenance crew and our food service and several others for that matter, are pretty unsung heroes through all this. Once we made the decision to close school, we sent instructional staff home on that Monday and just said, don't come in. And the reason for that was we wanted to create a safe space for them to come in and work on distance learning things. And so immediately, right, we looked to our maintenance staff, our custodial staff. And so we went through a district-wide disinfecting protocol on Monday. And a lot of it was actually done on Friday night already because we had already shifted to more stringent disinfecting routines. So our night crew had already done a lot of those things Friday night, but we were able to come in Monday and work through with them just what specific areas people would be working in for the remainder of the week. And so they were able to disinfect all those. And then those folks continued to work the rest of this week, and they've done so with a tremendously good attitude and a willingness to help and just basically saying, we're all in this together, whatever you guys need for our students. So it's been positive thus far, and we hope it's going to continue to stay that way.
And, you know, that brings up the thought of you have seniors that are supposed to graduate in June that are nearing the end of their K-12 experience. Can you give us any guidance or thoughts on, you know, what's going to go on for them? Because I know that must be a huge concern for parents of seniors and the seniors themselves.
Absolutely. I know it's a huge concern for them. And I think the only reason I haven't been asked about 100 times about it is because they're being very understanding of the situation right now. But I would say our district's position is this. We're not going to close down until the end of the school year, until that we know that's what we have to do. We're going to make decisions in a step-by-step basis. And we're going to do everything in our power to try to find some way to make this school year meaningful and memorable and positive for the class of 2020. There are certain things that are out of our control, but there are certain things that we can do. And so what exactly that looks like right now, I'm not sure. You know, is it we have 2 weeks of school in May and we're able to do some activities with them? Is it we have to push graduation back a couple weeks and we try to do some activities that build up to that? But we're trying to find creative ways to honor the work of those students and to honor the sacrifice and commitments that their families have made over the last 13 years to get them to this point. We don't take that lightly. And so we want to try to find a way to do it well. We're just not sure what that's going to look like yet.
I'm certain it's going to be memorable no matter what for them. I don't think any of us will forget the school year as it's unfolding at the end of 2020. For you personally, you know, is there anything that you really want the big takeaway for parents and for your neighbors, the people in your community to know? I know there's so much uncertainty. Is there maybe some things you are certain about that you could share with us all?
Well, the thing that I'm most certain about right now is that the strength of our community and our county is our relationships with one another. I just can't tell you how grateful I've been for not only the staff of Corning Union High School District and the community here, but the support of other staffs from other school districts and leaders in other school districts and public health. Within our county, I can say that we have really leaned in and relied on one another. And I just think that's a tremendous strength that you have in rural, small areas that you have to capitalize on in times like this. So that would be my big takeaway thus far. But talk to me in a couple of weeks and see if there's been new revelations. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, lastly, I'd like to ask you about when you were a vice principal. I know you were in charge of school safety, you know, dealing with possible shooting incidents and things like that, having to do lockdowns. Part of, you know, all of America has been dealing with that the last decade or more. Are there lessons that you learned in that have been helpful to you as the superintendent now?
I think probably the biggest thing that I learned in some of those emergency situations is that being transparent with parents and being honest with them and allowing them to understand that legitimate challenges that you're facing and keeping their students safe is okay, that most people are pretty reasonable when you're straightforward and transparent with them about what you're trying to accomplish. And oftentimes you find solutions for that. And so that's kind of been our mode in this crisis too, is just, we don't have all the answers figured out, but we're going to try and communicate with you as much as we can, be as transparent as we can, and hope that we can pull together and figure out a way to make the best of this.
That was Jared Kaler, superintendent of the Corning Union High School District, speaking with NSPR's Dave Schloem. And that's your program for Monday, March 23rd, 2020. For more about anything you heard, visit our website, mynspr.org. And while you're there, let us hear from you. Tonight's special coverage was produced by Mark Albert, Ken Duvall, Christian Solis, and Phil Wilkie. Our engineer is Matt Fidler. Thanks for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and this is special coverage on the coronavirus pandemic from North State Public Radio. We'll be back tomorrow evening at 6:30. Until then, stay safe, stay informed, and stay tuned.